close, so close I thought she intended to bite him. In a venomous whisper, she said, "I know what you want. I know what you long for. But listen to me, you pathetic, unformed thing, neither human nor white. I have but one vial left of the potion. One. If we use it now, we will not have it later, when perhaps it will be essential that you have strength. So find a way into him, and do it now, or I will kill you. It is that simple. If you cannot do your work, you are useless. I will leave you behind to rot." She pushed him away from her. I watched Vindelire's face as each word struck him and sank in like a separate arrow. He believed her with absolute certainty, and so did I. If he failed her today, she would kill him. I didn't wonder how or when, because I knew she would do it. And then I would be left alone with her. That thought struck me like an axe blow. I saw Vindelire's shoulders rise and fall, as his panicky breathing began to accelerate. Without thinking, I reached out and took his hand. "Try," I begged him. His wide eyes darted to mine. "Try, my brother," I said in a softer voice. I would not, could not, bear to look at Dwalia. Did she sneer to see us frightened? Did she rejoice at how she had hammered us into an alliance? I did not want to know. Vindelire's pudgy hand closed on mine. It was warm and moist, as if I'd put my hand into something's mouth, and I wished I could withdraw it. But now was not the time to instill any doubt in him. He took a shuddering breath, and then I felt him settle himself. But more than that, I felt him gather his magic, and suddenly I knew that no matter what Dwalia might believe, this was Farseer magic. I knew a moment of outrage that somehow he had stolen such an ability. Then I felt him bubbling it toward the merchant. How often had I felt my father or my sister use this magic? They had employed it as if it were the sharpest knife one could imagine, arrowing toward the person they sought to reach. Vindelire pushed his lips out and then sucked them in, straining to reach the merchant, as if he were sloshing water toward him. I wondered how he had ever managed to control Duke Elic and his men with such sloppy magic. Perhaps then he had been stronger in it, strong enough that he had not needed to refine his skill. Perhaps it was like the difference between smashing an ant with a brick or squishing it with a fingertip. The magic moved sluggishly toward the merchant. It reached him and washed against him. But he was so full of himself, so radiant in his enthusiasm for what he was selling, that he felt it not at all. It rolled aside from him. This I felt as Vindelire's hand engulfed mine. I felt, too, the drop in his confidence. The magic grew softer and less focused as his despair grew. "You can do this," I whispered to him, and willed that he would feel confidence, that he would try again. Once, when I fell from a tree and ran to my mother with my elbow bleeding, I was unaware that much more blood was escaping from my nose. The magic that moved out of me and through Vindelire was like that. I felt no sensation of something vital leaving me until suddenly I was aware of the effect. Vindelire had marshaled what magic he could and was rolling it toward the merchant like a badly tumbled stone. Then my magic, a magic so like my father's and sister's that I knew it was mine, guided his, and it was abruptly not a badly tumbled stone, but a well-flung one. I saw it strike the merchant, saw how in the midst of his smiling chatter, his eyes widened and his words suddenly failed him. I felt what Vindelire commanded him.
"You will want to do what Dwalia wishes you to do."
When he conveyed
"Dwalia,"
it was an image of her as well as a feeling of who she was. Important, wise, a woman to be obeyed, a woman to be feared. The merchant's gaze roved over the crowd and found Dwalia. He regarded her with awe. She nodded to him, and to Vindelire she said softly,
I knew you could do it if you wanted to badly enough.
Vindelire dropped my hand and clapped both hands over his mouth, astonished at what he had accomplished. As for the merchant, he continued his spiel, selling golden nuts and wonderful fortunes to buyer after buyer until every little door on his cabinet stood open and plundered. He announced to the crowd that he had no more fortunes to sell that day, and they dispersed, drifting and chatting, some still perusing the long tails of paper with the fortunes written on them. We stood where we were as his audience dispersed. He glanced at Dwalia not once, but repeatedly as he shut each little door of his wonderful cabinet and slowly stepped down from his cart. His horse turned its head and snorted questioningly, but the merchant walked toward us, his expression puzzled. Dwalia did not smile. Vindelire retreated behind her, and I followed him as my chain would allow.
You have done a wicked thing,
Dwalia said her first words to him. The merchant stopped and stared at her, his mouth twisted as if he would be sick.
You have smuggled fortune nuts out of Claris. You know it is forbidden. Those who buy a fortune there know it must be kept in their home, in a place of honor. They know it must not be given away or sold. But somehow you have acquired dozens of them. Your charade with tapping the nuts to open them did not fool me. They had been opened, and the revelations inside were given to those who had paid well for them. How did you get them? Did you steal them?
No, no, I am an honest merchant.
He looked horrified at the suggestion of theft.
I buy and I sell. I have a sailor friend who brings me extraordinary merchandise. He does not come to this port often, but when he comes, he brings me the nutshells and the fortune papers to put inside them. I am known for my rarities, such as the fortunes spun by the pale folk. I have sold them here for years. If there was a crime, it was not mine. I only buy them and sell them on to folk eager for them, folk who know that a silver is a fair price for such rare things.
Dwalia glanced at Vindelire. His eyes widened, and I felt him push his magic toward the man. It sogged against him like a wet cloth, but he gave a tiny nod to Dwalia. She smiled, and it made my bite mark a horrid, crawling thing on her face.
You know you have done wrong, she accused him. You should give me the silver, for I come from the Pale Ones, the Whites, and the Four. Give me the money you have gained from your deceit, and I will beg them to forgive you. And tell me the name of your friend and the ship that brought him here, and for him, too, I will beg pardon.
He stared at her. He hefted the pouch of silvers he had gained. I had counted the little doors in his cabinet. There were 48 of them. 48 pieces of silver, and some were the larger pieces that he had cajoled from his buyers. It was a magnificent sum, if a silver here was worth what a silver was in Buck. He stared at Dwalia, and then tilted his head before he shook it at her.
You're a peculiar beggar. You accuse me of theft, and then try to rob me? I don't even know why I spoke to you at all. But I'm to be wed tomorrow, and the old saying tells us to pay a debt you don't owe before your wedding day, and you'll never have a debt you can't pay. So here's a silver for you, a debt I don't owe.
As he spoke, he fished in his pouch and brought up a single piece of silver. He held it between two fingers, then flipped it suddenly into the air. Dwalia clutched at it, but it slid between her fingers into the dirt. Vindelire squatted to get it for her, but she set her shoe firmly on the coin. The fortune merchant had turned away from us and was walking toward the front of his cart. Without looking back, he added,
You should be ashamed of yourself. Feed that child something, and if you've a heart at all, take that chain off her throat and find her a home.
Dwalia kicked Vindelire hard. He fell onto his side, gasping.
The name of the ship,
she demanded of both, and I felt the pained thrust of Vindelire's desperate magic. The man was mounting to the seat of his cart. He didn't look back at us.
The sea rose.
He took up the reins and shook them. His horse moved placidly forward. I wondered if he even realized that he had spoken to us. Dwalia crouched to pick up her coin. She stood, and as Vindalaya started to rise, she kicked him down again.
Don't think this pays for all, she warned him.
She jerked my chain viciously, and against my will I cried out. And then, to my shame, tears flowed from my eyes. I shuffled and sobbed after her as Vindalaya lumbered to his feet and followed us like a kicked dog. Dwalia did stop to buy food. Cheap, dry bread for Vindalaya and me, a savory, flaky roll stuffed with meat and vegetables for her. She watched the vendor count her coins back to her with an eagle's keen stare and stuff them into a fold of her clothing. She ate as she walked, and so did we. I longed for water to wash down the dry bread, but she did not pause near the public well we passed. She took us down to the waterfront. The harbor was a great circle of calm water with fingers of docks that reached out. The biggest ships were anchored out in the placid bay, and little boats skated back and forth over the water, like many-legged water insects, bearing people and supplies to them. Closer to us, smaller ships were tied to the docks and piers, creating a wall of hulls and a forest of masts between us and the open water. We three beggars entered the jostling world of carts and longshoremen and prosperous merchants, inviting one another to tea or wine or discussing their latest purchases and sales. We limped and shuffled among them, either invisible and unnoticed, or cursed and reviled for making the traffic pause or standing where someone wished to walk. Dwalia sounded to me like a breadmonger as she called out,
"The sea rose? Where does she dock? The sea rose! I'm looking for the sea rose!"
No one answered her. The best she got was a shake of the head to say they didn't know the vessel. At last, Vindalaya tugged at her sleeve and pointed wordlessly between two ships. We had a narrow view of the bay and a fine vessel with no figurehead, but a glorious bouquet of flowers at her bow with a large red rose in the center of it. It was fat and long, the largest ship in the harbor.
"Might it be that one?"
he asked her timidly. Dwalia halted despite the push and press of folk around us and stared at the vessel. The ship's bare masts pointed at the sky, and she rode high in the water. Her crew moved briskly on her decks, busy with sailorish chores I didn't understand. As we watched, a small boat with six men at her oars pulled alongside. A large crate of something was lowered to the waiting boat, and then a man descended to it. Someone bumped me hard and said something vicious in a language I didn't know. I cringed closer to Vindalaya, and he in turn huddled behind Dwalia. She neither moved nor appeared to notice that we were blocking traffic.
"We need to see where they go,"
she announced in a low voice. As the boat moved away from the ship, she suddenly set out at a trot, and I was forced to keep pace with her. It was hard to see where the rowing boat was going, for our view was often blocked by tethered ships or large stacks of crates and bales. On we went, and on, with my bare feet protesting both the uneven cobbles and the splintery docks. I tore a toenail, and it bled. She darted in front of a team and wagon, dragging me behind her so that I felt the hot breath of the horses when they jerked their heads and protested, and the angry shout as the teamster called me vile names. Finally, we stood on a well-built dock. The sky overhead was wide and blue, sprinkled with screaming gulls. The wind blew past me, stirring my clothes and hair. I reached up and touched it, astonished at how it had grown. Had it been so long since my father and I had sheared our heads for grief at my mother's death? It seemed but days, and it seemed like years. Vindalaya and I stood side by side while Dwalia paced up and down, every step a small tug at my chain. As soon as the boat drew near, she began shouting,
"Are you from the Sea Rose? Are you her captain?"
A finely dressed man, who did not pull an oar but rowed grandly beside the wooden crate, looked up at her in distaste. His lips curled back as if he could already smell us. The captain stood in his boat, ignoring how it rocked as his men climbed up and made the lines fast. A davit was swung out over the water. After supervising the transfer of the wooden crate to the dock, He climbed the ladder up to the docks, ignoring Dwalia's frantic queries as if she were but another squawking gull. As if we were of no consequence, he brushed his hands on his black trousers and straightened his dark green jacket. It had two rows of silver buttons down the front, and his cuffs were likewise secured with silver. The shirt he wore beneath his fine jacket was a paler green, and the collar sparkled with jewel studs. He was a handsome fellow, handsome as a jaybird. He took something from his pocket, opened a little pot. He rubbed his finger in something, and then smeared it over his lips. All the while, he stared over our heads toward the busy shore as if we did not exist. His crew members were not so reserved. Their shouts of appalled merriment at the sight of us were impossible to misunderstand in any language. One woman moved behind Dwalia and mocked her stance and face, contorting her features and behaving like a half-wit. An older sailor gave her a rebuking shove and then dug in his pocket to offer Vindelire a handful of coppers. Vindelire looked to Dwalia, and when she simply continued to shout her queries at them, he received the coppers into his cupped hands. With that, the crew was finished with us. They strode away with the rolling gait of experienced hands, laughing among themselves, all save one, who sat forlornly in the rowboat below, evidently consigned to that duty. Dwalia screeched curses after them, and then spun on Vindelire, slapping him so hard that some of the coppers jumped out of his hand, bounced on the planks, and fell through the cracks into the water below. Heedless of my chain, I managed to secure two of them and clutched them tightly. Somehow, I would find a way to turn them into food. Somehow. Vindelire cringed as Dwalia beat him with her fists and kicked him. He hunkered down into a ball, hiding his head in his arms, and giving small cries of pain in response to each of her blows. I seized my chain in both hands, jerked it free of her grip, and lashed her with it twice. She staggered sideways, but did not go into the water as I'd hoped. I turned and ran, a length of chain clanking and pinging against the dock planks as I fled. I expected it to happen, but it still hurt when someone stamped hard on the trailing chain, jerking me to a halt. Sobbing and bruised, hands at my throat, I turned back, ready to attack Dwalia. But it was Vindelire who had landed on my dragging leash. His cheeks were still reddened from Dwalia's blows. Nonetheless, he had done her will. Dwalia was a puffing step behind him. He looked up at her, pathetically loyal, and held my chain out to her.
"No!"
I shrieked, but she stooped down, seized the chain, and snapped it wildly back and forth so that my head lashed with it. I saw flashes of light and fell to the dock. She kicked me twice, panting with fury.
"Get up!"
she commanded. She was going to kill me. Not at once, but with continued abuse. I knew it with the certainty of a dream. I would die at her hands, and with me would die the future that should have been. I was the future they sought to destroy by capturing and holding the unexpected son. I felt half stunned by the knowledge. Had it been in my mind all that time, finally to be shaken free by Dwalia's abuse of me? I felt sick with the insight. It was no dream that flashed before my eyes, as if I had stared at the sun. It was a future. I had to find the path to that future. I would find it, or I would die trying.
"Get up,"
she repeated. I got to my hands and knees, then staggered to my feet and stood, reeling. Snarling, she shoved her hand down the front of her shirt. Her fist came back up, gripping something. Vindelire quivered, his attention completely focused on her hand. Dwalia beamed at him with cruel power. Slowly, she uncurled her fingers until I saw she held a glass tube that contained a cloudy liquid. She shook her head at him slowly.
"You are weak. So weak, but when a broken shovel is the only tool one has to dig a hole, then one mends it and uses it. So one last time, I will fill you with strength. One last chance I will give you to redeem yourself. But if you fail me again in the slightest way, I will make an end of you. No, I will not put it into your hands. Sit down, tilt your head back, and open your mouth."
I had never seen anyone obey so quickly. Vindaliya sat upon the dock and leaned back, his eyes closed and his mouth opened wider than I had ever imagined it could. And he sat like that, perfectly still and waiting, while she laboriously pried a glass stopper from the tube and slowly, so slowly, tipped the tube over his mouth. A lumpy liquid, yellowish yet threaded with silver, drooled slowly from the tube. I felt revulsion at the sight of it, and the smell that reached me was that of vomit. I gagged as it trickled into his mouth and he swallowed it. A moment later, like the lapping of water in a pond when a stone is thrown into it, the wave of his fresh power touched me. Had I thought my father was like a boiling pot with a steam of magic coming from him? What I felt from Vindaliya was not steam, but a scalding blast of power. Both body and mind, I curled small against it, going as tight and hard as a nut against that surging current. Vindaliya's eyes fluttered wildly, and his whole body quivered in ecstasy. The trickle of lumpy fluid continued to flow thick and clotted and disgusting, and as he swallowed and then swallowed again, the battering of his magic against me grew only stronger. I curled tighter and smaller, body and mind. Dwalia gauged what she gave him, righting the tube when there was perhaps a quarter of the fluid left in it, then stoppered it again. I shut my eyes and strove to feel nothing, hear nothing, smell and taste nothing, for any sense I left unguarded might bring him blasting into my mind. For a time, I was nothing. Senseless and without being, I barely existed. I could not say how much time passed, but eventually I felt his regard lessened or focused elsewhere and dared to open my senses. I smelled tarry wooden deck and seaweed and heard the distant mewling of seabirds, and Dwalia's voice just as mewling and constant.
When the captain returns, he will see us as lordly and respectable. We are people he wants to impress. He will long to please me, ache for my regard. All his crew will see us that way. He will take these coppers as if they were golds. He will be anxious to set sail for Clares as soon as he possibly can, and will provide us every comfort that can be offered. Can you do that?
My vision swam, but I saw Vindaliya's beatific smile.
I can do that, he said dreamily. I can do anything right now.
And I feared that he could. My fear touched him. He turned toward me, and his smile was as unbearably bright as looking at the sun.
Brother,
he drawled out, pleased with himself, as if he spoke to a toddler hiding behind a chair.
I see you now.
I retreated, smaller and smaller, shell tighter and harder, but he followed me effortlessly.
I do not think you can hide from me now.
He teased me gently, and I could not. Layer after layer after layer of me, he knew, secrets peeling away from me like skin from a blister, getting closer and closer to the raw heart of me. He knew now of how Shun and I had fled. He knew of my day with my father in the town. He knew of the bloody dog, and he knew of my quarrel with my tutor. It had been so long since Wolffather had spoken to me, but suddenly I knew what he would tell me. Cornered? Fight. I threw my shields aside.
No! I snarled. It is you who cannot hide from me!
Physically, I came to my feet, but that was not how I faced him. How to describe it? He had ventured too close to me. He had pushed in, and suddenly I enveloped him. I did not know what I did or how I did it. Did I remember doing this once? Did I remember my father doing it? My sister? I wrapped my awareness around him and trapped him. He was too surprised to struggle. I do not think he had ever imagined that someone could do this to him. I pressed hard on him, and suddenly it was like crushing a boiled egg in my hand. His shell broke. It had not been a thick one. I doubt he had ever had to guard his mind against another. And I knew him. That knowledge did not come to me in any sequence. It simply was mine. I knew that he had been born with an oddly shaped head, and that was enough for him to be set aside from the others. He was barely a wight to their eyes, just a flawed and useless baby, given over to Dwalia, one of several squalling infants born that season who were less than perfect. And in knowing what had befallen him, I learned of Dwalia too, for she had raised him from infancy. Once she had been respected, the handmaiden who had served a highly regarded wight. She had seen her mistress sent out into the world to do great things, but when the woman failed and fell, Dwalia's fortune had perished with her. Disgraced and delegated to demeaning tasks, Dwalia became a servant to the midwives and healers of Clarys. The business of Clarys was the breeding of wights for the harvesting of their precognizant dreams, and Dwalia had hoped to be entrusted with a promising wight of the purest bloodlines. But she was no longer trusted there. Given a set of defective twins to dispose of, she had instead suckled them on a pig and kept them alive, hoping that their imperfect bodies might conceal powerful minds. Daily, she had reminded them that they owed their lives to her. Denied access to the perfect children given to others to groom and raise, she had only her rejected twins to cultivate. And cultivate them she did. Vindelire recalled peculiar diets, soporific herbs, sometimes when he was not allowed to sleep, times when he was given sleep-inducing concoctions for weeks to force him to dream. But as Vindelire and his sister Odessa had grown, they had shown no extraordinary abilities. All this and much that was sadder, I knew in an instant. Vindelire had not been able to dream for her, other than the one pathetic dream he had shared with me. Odessa dreamed, but the images she saw were so formless as to be useless. Yet Dwalia had been merciless in the efforts she made to force her protégés to produce dreams for her. He knew that she had begun to serve as Felidi's assistant at his dissections and inquisition, for he had to tidy after them. But he did not know why Simph had come to her with a rare elixir made from the fluids of a sea serpent's body. It was said to give intense and prophetic dreams to any who took it, followed by an agonizing death. This Vindelire had overheard. The first time she administered it to Vindelire, she had chained him to a table. It had burned his tongue and mouth so badly that to this day he could not taste food. Yet the pain had been followed by an intense ecstasy and an expanding of his thought so that he could share his mind with others. When some nearby prisoners fell, writhing, screaming, holding their mouths, Dwalia realized they felt his pain. And from there, in careful testing, she had discovered that he could make others believe the thoughts he pushed toward them. Those of white heritage were seldom vulnerable to his manipulation. For years, as he developed his ability under her secret tutelage, he had believed Dwalia was immune to it and had never dared to try it against her. He was never allowed to speak of the elixir. Dwalia insisted to others that he was extraordinary, with the ability to find tiny paths where others believed him and obeyed him. So much I learned in that shattering of our walls. My invasion of his mind stunned him. I weighed my strength against his as he struggled to discover what had just befallen him. Then I acted, using the hereditary magic of the Farseers almost by instinct. "You cannot master me," I told him, pushing the thought at him with every ounce of strength I had. "You cannot break my walls." And then I slammed shut the gates to myself. When next I knew I was me, Dwalia was nudging me, not gently, with her foot. "Get up," she was saying in a falsely kind voice. "Get up. It's time for us to go aboard." The world wavered before my eyes. I saw her sumptuous dress, the spill of lace from the low-cut bosom, the extravagant flowers in her hat. She was young, no older than Shun, and her long black ringlets gleamed with perfumed oil. Her eyes were a rare shade of deep blue, framed with long lashes. Her skin was flawless. Her dapper serving man stood beside her. Then I blinked, and she was Dwalia with the chewed face and well-worn clothes. Vindelire was Vindelire. I wondered how the gathered sailors saw me. I stood reluctantly, my head still whirling. My hunger had become nausea. I contained it with a deep breath. The sailors were not looking at me, so I was a serving girl or slave, and not an attractive one. Twalia received their sidelong glances with a simpering smile. The captain of the Sea Rose had returned, and he was speaking to her in rapt tones. He ordered a swing prepared that she should not fuss her skirts, and guided it himself as the davit lowered her to the rowing boat. She looked back up at us.
"Quickly now! We board our ship, and soon we depart for Clarys."
I reached my hand to my throat. Vindelire gave my chain a tug.
"Quickly now,"
he ordered me in a cold voice. He did not smile. He began to descend the ladder to the small boat. The chain went tight and dragged me to the edge of the dock and toward a future I could not avoid.
Chapter 18. Silver Ships and Dragons.
I cannot deny his peculiar looks, but he seems a clever fellow, and I am certain that he is not a danger to me. How you can imagine he is sent by an enemy to kill me surprises me. The note that accompanied the lad said that many rulers now enjoy having a jester to amuse their court, and perhaps I would welcome this clever tumbler. His antics are most amusing, and I confess that when his sharp little tongue cut Lord Atri to shreds yesterday evening, I rather enjoyed it, since the man is a pompous boar. When he first arrived in his tattered clothing, bearing a sodden scroll, gifting him to me with the name of the gifter sogged away, my brother cautioned me, and even suggested I do away with him. Shade spoke quite plainly in the boy's hearing, for the lad had not spoken a word up to that point, and we had both assumed he was either a deaf mute or simple. But right away the lad piped up and said, "Dear King, please do not do a thing you cannot undo until you have considered well what you cannot do once you've done it." It was a clever thing to say, and it won me over. "Please, my dear, settle whatever it is in Farrow that you have to do, and then come home and be as amused with him as I am. Then you'll see that Lady Glade has exaggerated his peculiarities in her letter to you. He is such a scrawny spider of a child. I am sure that when he is better fed, he will not look so odd, and may gain a bit of colour. I think she dislikes him because he so well imitated her well-fed wattle. I so miss you, my desire, and look forward to your return. Why you must so often be absent from Buckkeep is a mystery and a sorrow to me. We are wed, husband to wife. Why must I retire to a lonely bed every night while you linger in Farrow? You are my queen now, and need no longer trouble yourself with the rule of Farrow."
Letter from King Shrewd to his second queen, Desire of Farrow. It looked more like a family gathering than a convening of people seeking to prevent a disaster. I thought of my own family and realized such gatherings were often both. Queen Etta's admiral had boarded while we were occupied with the figurehead. Wintrow Vestrit was already seated at the table, and Althea was brewing tea when we joined them in the stateroom. Wintrow Vestrit, chief minister to Queen Etta of the Pirate Islands and grand admiral of her fleet, looked so much like Althea that they could have been brother and sister, rather than nephew and aunt. They were of a height, and I judged there was less than a score of years between them. He was Malta's elder brother, and Amber had told me some of the brutal history of how he had been captured with Vivacia and forced to serve aboard her under the pirate Kennet. Oddly enough, she had told me that the slave tattoo beside his nose and his missing finger were actually the work of his father. Knowing all this, I had not expected the aura of calm about him, nor his subdued garb. Boyo moved swiftly and easily about his parents' stateroom, reacquainting himself with the familiar territory of his childhood ship. I saw him pick up a mug from a shelf, smile at it, and restore it to its place. He had his father's height, but his brow and eyes were from the Vestrit side, mirroring Althea's and Wintrow's. He was graceful as a cat. Wintrow had a grave demeanour, and when Althea served him a steaming cup of rum and lemon mixed with hot water, he took it with muted thanks. I guided Amber to a seat at the captain's table and joined her there. Lant took his place behind us. My youngsters ranged themselves along the wall and held a subdued silence. When all were served, Althea sat down heavily beside Brashen and heaved a sigh. She met Wintrow's gaze and said,
"Now you understand. When I said that our stopping here would change not just your life, but hundreds of lives, I don't think you grasped what I was telling you. I trust that now you do. You have seen the changes in Paragon. Prepare for Vivacia to do the same."
He lifted his mug and sipped from it slowly, collecting his thoughts as he did so. When he set it down, he said,
"It's something we can't alter. In situations like this, it is best to accept Sar's will and try to see what comes of it, rather than fighting against the inevitable. So, if Paragon is correct, after this last voyage, he will return to the Rainwilds and be given enough silver to become two dragons."
He shook his head, and a smile flitted briefly over his face.
"I'd like to witness that."
"I think it inevitable that you will witness Vivacia's transformation. If Amber and Paragon are correct, that such a metamorphosis is actually possible."
"I am virtually certain of it," Amber said softly. "You have seen how, given a small amount of silver, he can change his appearance at will. Given a large quantity, he can transform the wizard wood of his body into any shape he desires, and he will desire to be a dragon. Or two."
Clef spoke up, and no one seemed to think it was out of place as he asked, "But will he be a real dragon, of flesh and blood, or a wooden dragon?" A silence fell around the table as we mulled that over.
"Time will tell," Amber observed. "He will be transforming from wizard wood to dragon, not entirely different from a dragon's body absorbing the wizard wood of its cocoon as it hatches."
Boyo had drawn closer to his parents. He looked from one to the other, and then asked, "This is real? This can actually happen? It's not one of Paragon's wild fancies?"
"It's real,"
Brashen confirmed. His son stared into a future only he could see, one he had never imagined. Then he spoke in a whisper. "He has always had the heart of a dragon. I felt it when he held me in his hands and flew me over the water when I was a child." His words trickled away. Then he asked, "Has he enough wizard wood in his body to make two dragons? Won't they be rather small?" Amber smiled.
"We cannot know yet, but small dragons grow. From what I understand, dragons continue to grow as long as they live, and few things can kill a dragon."
Wintrow drew a deep, considering breath. He looked away from Amber to Brashen and Althea.
"Are you financially solid?"
he asked gravely. Brashen wobbled his head in a way that was not yes or no.
"We have resources. The loot from Igrot's hoard was substantial, and we were not wasteful of our share. But money alone is neither wealth nor a future for our son. We've no home save here on Paragon, no life or employment beyond plying our trade on the Rainwild River and in Bingtown. So yes, we have sufficient funds that we can eat and sleep inside a house for the rest of our days. Inside a house? There's a future I never sought. But something to leave to Boyo? A life for us to live? Well, that's harder for us to chart."
Wintrow was nodding slowly. A man, I thought, who seemed to think before he spoke. Just as he drew breath and opened his mouth to say something, we heard a shout from outside.
"Permission to come aboard! Refuse it!"
Wintrow ordered. Brashen was at the door of the stateroom in two strides.
"Refused!"
he shouted into the night, and then spun on Wintrow, demanding,
"Who is it?"
But the voice outside shouted,
You can hardly deny me permission to board the ship whose name I bear.
Peregrine Kennetson. Wintrow spoke in the brief gulch of silence before the ship bellowed out,
Permission granted, Paragon. Paragon, my son.
Althea went so pale, she was more greenish than white. I had heard a strange note in the ship's voice, a difference in timbre.
Sweet Tsar,
Wintrow breathed into the quiet. He sounded almost like Kennet. Brashen looked back at his wife over his shoulder. His face was stone. Then his gaze found Wintrow.
I don't want him talking to the ship, he said in a low voice. I don't want him on this ship,
Wintrow agreed. He strode to the door, and Brashen edged aside to let him pass.
Paragon!
Wintrow shouted, and there was command in his voice.
Here and now!
The figure who answered Wintrow's summons was no boy or youth, but a man, dark-haired, with an aquiline nose and a finely sculpted mouth. His eyes were a shockingly intense blue. His clothing was as handsome as he was, and the emerald earrings he wore were large, diamonds glittering around the green jewels. I judged him to be older than Boyo, but not by much, and he was softer. Physical work pounds a boy into a different sort of manhood. Boyo had that physique, but the prince was a house cat in comparison. Kennet's son smiled with even white teeth.
I present myself,
he said to Wintrow with a mocking bow, and then leaned past him to peer into the cabin.
Trelvestret, you are here too. It seems you've convened a party and not invited me. Well, that's cold of you, my young friend.
Boyo spoke softly. It's not like that, Kennetson. Not like that at all.
You've come to know each other?
Althea asked quietly, but received no response. Wintrow spoke in a low, controlled voice.
I want you off this ship. We both know that your mother does not approve of your coming here.
Kennetson cocked his head and grinned.
I also know that my mother is not here.
Wintrow did not return his smile.
A queen does not have to be present to expect that her commands will be obeyed, especially by her son. Ah, but this is not the will of a queen, but the will of my mother, who fears for me, and it is time for me to live beyond her fears. In this case, her fears are well founded.
Wintrow countered.
You are not welcome aboard this vessel,
Brashen added in a flat voice. There was no anger in his tone, but there was danger. For an instant, Kennetson's face went blank with astonishment. Then we all heard a roar of disagreement from Paragon, the ship.
Send him forward! Send him forward to me!
Kennetson recovered himself, and his features shifted from shock to royal arrogance. I had not been so vividly reminded of Regal in many a year. His words were clipped, his anger palpable.
I believe this was my father's ship before it was yours. And I believe that even if I did not have an inherent right to be here, my authority as Prince of the Pirate Isles supersedes your captain's powers. I go wherever I wish to go.
On this deck, nothing overshadows the say of the captain,
Brashen informed him.
Paragon's roar blasted us.
Accept the will of the ship.
Kennetson canted his head at Brashen and smiled.
I believe I am summoned,
he said, and offered an elegant bow, complete with a sweep of his feathered hat, before turning and sauntering away. Brashen made a noise, but Wintrow stepped between Brashen and the door and blocked the captain from exiting.
"Please," he said, "let me talk with him. He has been consumed with curiosity about Paragon since he was 8 years old."
He turned his gaze to Althea.
"Any boy raised with no glimpse of Kennet, surrounded by dozens of men telling him hero tales of his father, would be enamored of this ship. He cannot resist."
"Coming aboard!"
someone roared, and in the next breath,
"Kennet-san! Prince you may be, but you do not defy me or your mother without a reckoning."
"Sorkor," Wintrow said with a sigh. "Oh, lovely. Just perfect."
"Sometimes Kennetson listens to him." Boyo sounded hopeful. Beside me, Amber breathed,
"Kennet's first mate in the old days."
"Sometimes,"
Wintrow agreed, and then turned and went to meet Sorkor. I heard the hasty mutter of their conversation, Sorkor's voice accusing, and Wintrow's defensive and reasonable. But my ears strained to hear a different set of voices. I heard the ship hail,
"Young Paragon!"
with joy, and the young man's more measured response.
"How can he?"
Boyo spoke into the quiet.
"After what Kennet did to you, after all you and Brashen have done for him, how can he be so joyous to receive Kennet's son?"
I wondered if I heard a twinge of jealousy beneath his outrage. His jaw was set, and he suddenly looked a great deal more like his father.
"He's Paragon. He's always been capable of things we can't even imagine."
Althea stood slowly. She moved as if she had suddenly aged, as if every joint in her body was stiff.
"I'm not my father," Brashen said suddenly. "Neither is he."
"He looks like him,"
Althea said uncertainly.
"Much as Boyo looks like you, and me. But he isn't either of us, and he's not responsible for anything we've done in our lives."
Brashen's voice was low and calm. Rational.
"Boyo,"
the young man said softly. "Haven't heard that name in a while. I'm almost used to being called Trelvestret now."
"I'm not. I don't think I hate him. Kennetson, I mean. And I don't judge him for his father."
Althea tried to find words for her thoughts, and continued as if her son had not spoken.
"I think I'm a better person than that. His father is not his fault, though I don't find him the least bit charming."
She looked sideways at Brashen and stood straighter. Determination came back into her face and voice.
"But I am concerned by what he might wake in Paragon. There is so much of my father in Vivacia, so much of my grandmother in the Vestrit family liveship."
She shook her head slowly.
"I always knew that Kennet must be a part of Paragon. He was a Ludluck, and the Ludluck family owned Paragon for generations. And we both know that Paragon absorbed all the abuse that Igrot heaped on Kennet, all the deep hurts and wrong. There was so much bloodshed on his decks in Igrot's day, so much cruelty. The pain and fear sank into him with the blood spilled on his planks. And then, when Kennet died, our ship took into himself all that Kennet had been since he'd abandoned Paragon. I thought Paragon had nullified it, outgrown it as children outgrow selfish ways and learn to have empathy for others. I thought..."
Her voice faltered into silence.
"We all bury things inside ourselves,"
Amber said, making me flinch. She was looking straight ahead, not at Althea, but I felt she had intruded into a private conversation.
"We think we have mastered them until they burst out."
Her hand was on the cuff of my shirt, and I felt it tremble.
"Well, what's done is done,"
Althea said abruptly.
"Time to face it."
She took Brashen's arm, and a look passed between them that reminded me of two warriors standing back to back in battle. As they walked away, Boyo and Clef fell in behind them, as if it were some sort of formal procession.
"Lead me,"
Amber demanded. We trailed after them with Lantern, Spark and Purr following us. The few members of her crew who had decided to stay aboard, despite where Paragon might take them, ghosted along after us. Lanterns illuminated the masts and bows of the anchored vessels in the harbour, and the moon had risen. The light was uneven, draping angled faces in veils of shadow. But the moonlight fell on Paragon's features, and his face was full of fondness. It was like approaching a puppet show in the middle of an act. Paragon's figurehead was twisted to look down at Kennet's son on his deck, and his profile showed me his smile. His namesake stood with his back to us, legs wide and hands clasped loosely behind his back. His stance spoke to me more of patience than awe. Behind him, Wintrow stood beside a heavy-set man with little hair left to his head, but a generous grey beard. He wore loose trousers tucked into high boots and a wide belt that held a curved sword over his equally generous belly. His shirt was so white that it seemed to gleam in the moonlight. The man was scowling, his arms crossed on his chest. I was abruptly reminded of Blade. Some old warriors are like good weapons. Their scars become the patina of experience and wisdom. Paragon was speaking.
"Then you will go with me? Sail with me this last time that I shall sail, before I manifest as the dragons I have always been."
Kennetson seemed amused by his question.
"I will indeed. I can think of no better way to spend my time. I'm weary of lessons in geometry and navigation and languages. Why do they teach me the stars if I'm never allowed to sail under them? Yes, I'll go with you, and you will tell me tales of my father as he was when he was my age."
A telltale dragon gleam passed through the ship's eyes. I thought he would refuse the boy, but he sounded judicious as he replied,
"Perhaps, as I think you are ready to hear them."
Kennetson laughed.
"Ship, I am Prince Paragon of the Pirate Isles. Do you not realize who Kennet's son is now? I am next in line for the throne."
The light that touched his face followed the hard lines of his smile.
"I command, I do not request."
Paragon turned away from him and spoke out over the water.
"Not on my decks, Kennetson. Never on my decks."
"And you are not voyaging off anywhere, Paragon Kennetson,"
Wintrow added firmly.
"Sorkor is here to take you back to your chambers. You should be dressing even now for an evening of cards with the dignitaries from the Spice Islands. Your mother, Queen Etta, expects both of us to be there, and if we do not depart now, we will both be late."
Kennetson turned slowly to face Wintrow.
"And I do pity you, Chief Minister, that you will face her wrath alone. But there it is. When I return to the palace tonight, I intend to pack for a sea voyage, not dress for a game of cards with a lady who laughs like a horse neighing."
A silence fell. Then Sorkor said to Wintrow,
"I'm trying to remember the last time I thrashed him to Howley. I think he might be due for another."
The prince crossed his arms on his chest and drew himself up straight.
"Touch me and I'll have you in chains before morning."
He gave a contemptuous snort.
"I'd have thought you'd have tired of playing nursemaid years ago. I scarcely need a nanny following me about. I'm not a willful child for you to bully. Not any more."
"No," the older man shook his head woefully. "You're worse. You're a spoiled boy dressed in a man's fine clothes. If I thought your mother would ever agree to it, I'd tell her that the best thing for you would be to send you off with Trell as a deckhand.
to learn a bit of the trade that your father knew from the bones out when he was half your age.
Brash and Trell spoke.
He's a bit too old to learn it, I fear. You missed your chance, both of you.
Strange look crossed his face.
He reminds me of a spoiled merchant's son who thought he was a trader.
There is a way a boy stands when he does not wish to admit that words have struck him. Kennetson stood that way, a bit too still, shoulders a bit too stiff. His speech was precise as he said,
I shall be returning to the palace now, but not to dress and play dice with the Spice Island monkeys. Ship, I will see you again in the morning.
He swung his gaze to Brashen and Althea.
I trust you'll have my quarters awaiting me when I return. The stateroom I saw when I first came on board would be adequate, and please take on appropriate food and drink for me.
He walked through us, but I saw he chose a path that did not require anyone to step aside for him, and knew he doubted his ability to face any of us down. We listened to the sharp thuds of his boots on the deck. Then he was over the railing and clambering down a rope ladder, shouting at some poor soul who had been left waiting in a small boat for him. The sound of the moving oars was a gentle shushing in the night.
Do you really think so?
Sorkor had a deep voice, and it was full of slow dismay. For a moment, I couldn't understand what he was asking of Wintrow, but it was Brashen he was looking at in the darkness. The captain of the Paragon stared down at the deck.
No, not really, he admitted. Though I was younger when my father threw me out of the house and made my brother his heir. It was hard to find my own way, but I did. It's not too late for Kennet's son.
He heaved a great sigh. But it's not a task I want.
Sorkor looked up toward the moon, and the light fell on his face. His brow was wrinkled, his lips pursed in thought. Then he said in a gruff voice, But the ship's right. He should sail with you. It's his last chance, his only chance, to know this deck under his feet. To sail on the ship that shaped his father.
He swung his gaze to meet Brashen's startled gaze.
You should take him.
Wintrow started.
What?
But Sorkor flapped a knobby hand at him, silencing his objection. The older man cleared his throat.
I've failed the boy. When he was small, I was too glad to have any piece of his father that was left to us. I cherished him and kept him from all harm. I never let him feel the pain of his own mistakes.
He shook his head.
And his mother still dotes on him and gives him what he desires. But it's not just her. I wanted him to be a prince. I wanted him in fancy clothes with clean hands. I wanted to see him have what his father earned for him, to be what his father would have expected of him.
He shook his head again.
But somehow, we didn't get that other part of him. He hasn't had to become a man,
Brashen observed flatly. The words were harsh, but his tone was not.
A voyage away from his mother might do it,
Sorkor suggested. Althea stepped suddenly in front of Sorkor. Her gaze went from him to Wintrow.
I don't want him. I have enough to deal with on this voyage. I've only a vague idea of where we're going, and no idea how we will be received there, or how long Amber's little errand will take, or when we'll be back. Perhaps it hasn't been revealed to you, Sorkor, but we go to deal death and vengeance. We very well may end up fleeing for our lives, or be dead ourselves. I won't be responsible for the well-being of the Prince of the Pirate Islands, let alone his survival.
But I will.
It was Paragon who spoke. We all felt and heard that response. It thrummed through the ship's bones, and it reached our ears not as a shout, but as an assertion. I wanted no more additions to our company on this voyage, let alone a spoiled prince. So I drew breath to make my own objection and felt Amber's sudden clutch on my wrist. In a low voice, she said,
"Hush, as they say in Chale said, you don't have a dog in this fight."
Since we had come aboard Paragon, I had felt control of my plans slipping ever farther from my grip. Not for the first time I wished I'd come alone and unhelped.